From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on June 4th, 2014 at the White House. First Lady Michelle Obama announced the Mayor's Challenge to End Veteran Homelessness. To meet that challenge, communities had to achieve a status of functional zero, which means that housing is available for every homeless veteran who wants it. And that means a full accounting of the homeless veteran population, understanding who they are, where they are, and what services they're seeking or not. Yesterday, HUD praised Rochester as a model for cities across this country. This hour, we look at how Rochester is reaching the functional zero status, what it means for our homeless population, and we'll also then broaden the discussion about serving the homeless population at large. Let me welcome my guest for the hour. Todd Baxter's here, the executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center. Todd, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Aaron Militello's here, a program manager for the Healthcare for Homeless Veterans program at the VA. Aaron, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Carol Wheeler is here, manager for housing for the City of Rochester and chairperson for the Continuum of Care. Carol, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Todd, you know, you go back to June 2014, and certainly it is an important sentiment from the First Lady and the White House, but it's not a new one, the idea that veteran homelessness is a problem. So kind of take us back there. I mean, there are certain things that are already kind of rolling out, and you're still relatively new at the time. I think you were starting at your job
right
around that same time. What did that change, if anything, when it came to the approach of trying to help veteran homelessness in this country?
Well, one of the things you've seen, the decentralizing of the ability to, or the attempt to take care of the homeless veteran, it was usually a centralized effort by the VA and HUD. But when they took the challenge to the mayors had to have some ownership if they were going to accept that challenge. So it became a community issue, which changed a lot. And then you've seen a lot of the dollars, the federal dollars being decentralized to local nonprofits and local governments to handle the problem differently in their community, because each community is totally different, each population is different, and the service providers are different. So that's one of the things was there was more of, I think, of an ownership. I think it was a brilliant move to challenge the mayors, and then the mayors' names are attached to that, and that's quite
you
a challenge.
You are an accountability sort of an ownership guy, aren't you?
Yeah, so there's a name with it now, and it's not this big, huge federal government's problem. It's the local community's problem, and I think we took on that challenge as a community.
And one of the things the First Lady said on that day in June of 2014 was that they had an ambitious timetable. They were challenging communities to try to get this problem sort of, well, solved. I mean, homelessness is always going to be an issue, really sort of get to functional zero by 2015, if you could. That seemed really ambitious. Did it seem ambitious to you?
Yeah, absolutely, over the top. You know, it was a challenge. We actually, went to staff meetings and laughed about it. We're like, this is impossible. This problem's been around for years and years and years, and the anticipation is that we're going to be able to fix it that quick. But again, going back to the collaboration, you're going to hear many times today, the awesome collaboration. It wasn't just the city of Rochester's problem then. You know, the city mm-hmm. challenged all the other people to come together with help with the VA and everybody else. Everybody got in this community of care and put their head towards it. And it's a problem you can rally around pretty easily. You know, homelessness, children's homelessness, veterans homelessness. I mean, we can all rally around that.
And Carol, what was the city of Rochester's reaction to that challenge?
Our reaction was that, yes, bring it on. Bring it on. And I guess I say that is because before even the challenge was announced by Mrs. Obama, we have been comprehensively taking a look at what it is that we can do to reduce down the number of homeless individuals in our community and ideally eliminate all homelessness. Back in 2013, we finished up a report which was a homelessness reduction report, and it identified, okay, what are we doing here in Rochester now? What are some things that we can be doing better, and how should we proceed toward the future? And the study identified probably five areas that we needed to really work on. One was having coordinated access, making sure that everyone is collaborating, communicating, and making sure that if anyone find themselves homeless, there was a way or they would know how to access the services that would be available to them. It was also rapid rehousing, making sure that we identify landlords that would be willing to house those that are currently homeless. And then we wanted to make sure that we are developing more affordable housing in our community to make sure that we did have enough housing to go around. And then lastly, because sometimes it's not feasible for someone to move directly into permanent housing, and there might need to be some bridges. And one of those bridges in the past has really been hotel placements for people. And that was one of the things, too, that we wanted to make sure gets eliminated was the hotel placements, particularly for families.
Okay. Now, when we say functional zero, maybe Todd and Aaron can help fill us in on sort of defining that term. Functional zero means what, Aaron?
Functional zero means that we have adequate placement for veterans and their families on any given night in the city of Rochester. And I think what's really important to understand about functional zero is that every single agency takes ownership of this issue. And speaking for VA, VA cannot help every veteran that presents to our facility. If somebody has a bad conduct discharge or if somebody has an ineligibility that we have no control over, what's really cool about our Healthcare for Homeless Veterans program is that we will bring them in, we will talk with them, we will identify what their needs are, and if we can help them, we can. But if we can't, we have numerous agencies that we can reach out to make sure that they're taken care of. And what I said yesterday was, this is not a one-agency fight. This is a multiple-agency fight. And we have to rely on each other for those types of instances.
So, Aaron, do you know how many communities, how many cities are achieving functional zero when it comes to the veterans homeless population?
There are 22 approved right now, including two states. And Rochester was actually the 15th designated, so one of the top in the country.
Okay. And, Carol, you know, that is, I'm sure, a point of pride for the city and probably a priority to maintain going forward.
Absolutely. And one of the things, just kind of touching on those statistics, there were probably 888 mayors that took the challenge. But you see that there was just a small number that has truly been approved for functional zero.
Okay. So with Rochester now on this list, the question, my first question was, well, how do you know? How do you actually sort of do the outreach to make sure you've identified this population? And here are some numbers, and I'm sure Todd and Aaron can correct if I'm wrong here, but the numbers I have, the 2015 count, 55 homeless veterans, 17 were in emergency housing, 33 in transitional housing, one in what we call safe haven, four unsheltered, and all four unsheltered veterans had been offered and refused assistance. No veterans had requested services and remained unassisted. Is that the reason, is that the defining line for saying, okay, now we're functional zero, Aaron? Is that correct?
No, the line is that the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness had to determine a way that communities would be recognized for this achievement.
Okay.
So they identified specific criteria that communities had to reach. And a lot of those criteria have to do with using a housing first approach, using your community partners, but also it included a lot of outreach and knowing where your homeless veterans were. And we were able to say we knew where they were. They may not have all come into shelter, but we knew where they were. And additionally, the great part of what we do in this community is even if they don't want shelter that day, we keep going. We keep going out to reach out to them. We ask them over and over again because you don't know what time they're going to want to come into shelter. You know, it could be the fifth time that they see you. It could be the tenth time that they see you. You know, and unfortunately, we have people that don't want anything to do with the outreach workers, but we don't give up.
Yeah, and to state the obvious here, but this is an important point, that's true in the homeless population across the board, not just in veteran mm-hmm. populations. Though, Todd and Aaron, maybe you guys can kind of weigh in on whether 4 out of 55 who've been offered but declined services. Is that a sort of a normal proportion? I mean, that's less than 10% in our community. Is that a normal proportion? Is that low? Is that high historically? Do you know?
Yeah, based on my experience, it's normal. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to find this. I go back to my law enforcement hat, you know, and working with the community, the homeless community, and trying to get them in the shelters. There's always going to be that certain population just refusing to, you know, go back into the society or go back into government or whatever the reason they're withdrawing from society. Our first function there is to make sure they're safe. Okay, now are they in a safe environment? Are they okay where they are? And continue, like Aaron said, to continue to push and ask. And you never know what day they're going to actually. And we've seen it several times. There's several veterans that finally that one ask made the difference in my life. You know, so we appreciate you keep on coming. And going back to the survey, you know, the survey is a, you know, people are confused how we get those numbers. We are out. Last time we went out as a community, over 100 volunteers went out and hit every homeless shelter, hit every bridge, hit every place that we know. And they actually talk to every homeless person they can find and offer them not just veterans, but offer them the services that are out there that are being represented just with this report. So that's a point-in-time survey, and we do those point-in-time. So that survey is a point-in-time. Last year in 2015, we knew of those four veterans. We knew them by name, and that was one of the criteria the federal government was looking at. Yeah, we've identified them by name. And we go back out all the time and do those point-in-time surveys.
Okay, and Carol, you want to weigh in on that as well? Go ahead.
Sure. That point in time is very important, is held every year in the month of January, toward the end of January. And as Todd had mentioned, there were lots and lots of volunteers because we wanted to make sure that we identified everyone who was homeless. And one of the things that we did also is come back once we have identified, I guess, who was out there, is making sure that we have unduplicated counts. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that we're not double counting people. And so I just think that it was just a great effort by the entire community, because one of the things that was mentioned earlier, and totally agree, is not just a city issue, it's not just a veteran issue, but truly it is community that needs to come together to address the whole issue of homelessness.
Todd, I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I understand, because Todd mentioned up to 100 volunteers who actually do the footwork of being out there. Yes.
Well, that was this last time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. Okay, but that way you are trying to cover all of the ground and having personal interaction. With these homeless veterans. And I go back to that list of 55 homeless veterans. The number of veterans who wanted services but couldn't get them was zero. So that's obviously a big one. For the four, do we know, are they, you know, sort of still declining service? And how often are we visiting with them?
So at the time of that particular PIT count, I actually did the application to the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness to identify Rochester as having reached functional zero. And that four, three of them were living in their car, and one of them was completely unsheltered. The three that were living in their car felt comfortable in their car. They didn't want to be in a shelter where there was rules and regulations, and they didn't feel like they could handle some of the stimulation that occurred there because of some mental health issues. And we find that that happens pretty frequently. And so I'm happy to say that all three of those people living in their car are housed at this point. And that has a lot to do with the continued outreach that we do. Because if we can address the substance abuse or mental health issues that are sometimes plaguing some of these folks, we can really get to the heart of the issue and allow them to feel comfortable coming in.
To that point, we had a listener question. And by the way, listeners, if you want to call the program to weigh in on this, if you have questions or comments, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And Robert was writing to ask how many of that population have substance or mental health challenges. So I assume he means substance abuse. And do we know?
Generally speaking, nationwide, it's a hard number to wrap your head around, because when you're talking about military folks and you're talking about veterans, a lot of mental health issues are underreported. So that's a very difficult number. But I would say across the board, the general number is about 65% of our homeless veteran population that are dealing with substance or mental health issues.
65%. And that has...
And potentially even higher.
Okay. And so that has held pretty steady. But as you said, Aaron, once you identify that issue, you can take the steps toward, you know, helping. And it's not going to happen overnight.
It is not.
But have you seen the kind of success stories that at least let you know that the approach is starting to work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have outreach workers, at least specifically for the VA, that go out weekly to the shelters. They go out under bridges at midnight with the county and the chronically homeless work group. They're looking for folks. I've seen out our team bring in veterans who have been on the street to the Rochester Outpatient Clinic. They're seen that day. They're provided medical services that day. They're provided a mental health assessment that day. And that's how we coordinate care.
Do we have the beds and the facilities? You know, an ongoing discussion when it comes to mental health in general, not just in homeless, not just in veterans population, is do we have beds and facilities sufficient to handle this kind of a population? Do we right now?
Absolutely. We absolutely do. We are very proud, I think, as a community to say is that if a family or a veteran individual presents as homeless, we can get them housed that day 99% of the time.
We're going to get to your questions on the phone in just a second. Mary writes and wants to know if any of the homeless veterans locally are women.
Oh, absolutely. You know, right now there's, I believe, 9 women staying at the YWCA that are also identified as veterans. We at the Veterans Outreach Center are looking at that right now. We house 28 male veterans at the Veterans Outreach Center with our shelters, but no formal female housing or veterans with kids in tow. So we're looking at that right now, Evan. We just received a beautiful donation. We're getting ready to announce in the next couple months of buying a house in the South Wedge neighborhood that we're going to be able to house female veterans right here in Monroe County. You know, and as we talked in the past, I believe about veterans, you know, they like to be around other veterans, you know, so why a unique shelter for female veterans? Well, sometimes that's the stepping stone they're looking for. Sometimes that's the transitional opportunity they were looking for, to be around other female veterans. Is such a unique population. And when it comes to shelter, you know, we take advantage of it. Housing veterans is different than housing other homeless folks. We got the advantage. These people were in the military at one time. They know discipline. They know punctuality. They know systems, and they like systems. So I always say to my friends in the other homeless shelter communities, you know, that we have an advantage that other folks don't, and that we take advantage of that. So female housing, no, nothing. We have to go to Avon, the closest dedicated female housing, or rely on our partners, people from Willow, formerly ABW, YWCA, will always work with us on our female population.
But again, that's changing soon.
Yeah, we're very excited about it. Yeah, we've identified that. You know, the estimation in the next few years, the Department of Defense, the military is going to be 1/5 female. Mm-hmm. So the math just tells you in a few short years, 1/5 of the veteran population is going to be female. And we weren't ready for them in this community. And we have great partners. But the fact is, I think, especially an organization like the VOC, that we praise ourselves as supporting the government on housing veterans, that we didn't have a facility dedicated to female.
All right, let me go out to Clifton Springs. This is Larry in Clifton Springs. Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I have been listening carefully and of course, watching this history for over 40 years. And I've never, ever once heard anyone addressing this problem from the employment side, which means, you know, most people pay for a home with a job, and they're not trying to employ all veterans. We have massive underemployment in America, and it just seems, you know, almost ludicrous to blame 65% of veterans self-medicating or angry that they're not employed when they could do work. And I just don't understand why they're pretending that there is zero homelessness. I mean, I will say good things about Monroe County, but you go to Onondaga County and it's absolutely the opposite. So I just would like to hear some hope that a national policy will stop this underemployment and put people to work.
Larry, thanks for the phone call. And to be clear, the panel isn't saying there's zero veteran homelessness. Functional zero is the term, and that means zero veterans in your community are homeless and are asking for services and can't get them, at the very least, as a baseline. And that is certainly an achievement, but that doesn't mean there's no veteran homelessness, not at all. And that's so just to be clear on that. Now, let's kind of go around the table, because not to discount Larry's point. Larry's mm-hmm. point's an important one about employment, but Todd Baxter, we have talked plenty, and I know you continually work, probably every day, on employment issues for veterans, yes?
Absolutely. So he's correct. We believe in a philosophy of housing first. You know, it's the Maslow's hierarchy of, mm-hmm. of needs, right? We got to get these folks secure, get them safe, and get them stable. And then immediately we start working on simple things you would take, just like the caller said, you know, getting them to work, sweat equity, you know, getting them busy, getting them a sense of feeling back in the community, paying taxes, all those great things. Don't forget, these were proud Americans one day wearing a uniform.
That's right.
So they strive for that. They look forward to that. And the other side, you know, so we think about that. And there's also federal money that comes into our community, the HVRP grant, Homeless Veteran Reintegration Program. That's a DOL grant that comes to us. And last year with that grant, we were able to place almost 400 veterans in employment through our services at the Veterans Outreach Center. So, again, housing first, get them stable, but employment's a very, very important. And the other very important thing to us is getting these veterans reintegrated with their families or whatever that looked like, that structure. Getting them back with the families is another great stepping stone for them.
Larry, I'll come back to you in a second if you're still there. But, Aaron, you want to weigh in on that as well?
I do. You know, the VA has really targeted as looking at employment to make people successful. Just because they enter into one of our programs doesn't mean they're going to stay there forever. So I agree with Todd. We utilize a housing-first approach. We get them housed. The Healthcare for Homeless program at the VA has an employment specialist that works specifically with all of our veterans in transitional housing and in our HUD-VASH program to target the folks that can and want to be employed and figures out a way to get them there. They will assist them with resume writing. They will develop contacts with employers. I think that's something that we do collaboratively between VOC and VA and lots mm-hmm. of other community agencies very well. We mm-hmm. really do focus on employment.
Larry, you want to follow up? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, there's still two more problems that are just absolutely under-addressed, and that is there are many veterans who are disabled. They're not allowed to work. In my case, you know, I'm a truck driver that's not allowed to drive a truck because of my health conditions. Yet, nonetheless, Social Security might provide, a disability pension based on recent income, when a lot of veterans haven't had jobs for a very long time, so they're going to get very little Social Security. But the wait time for a veteran's disability pension is years and years. And most veterans know this, and most veterans don't even apply because they've been denied many years in the past or whatever. So I just am still thinking that anytime you say, you know, almost zero, the public is only hearing those two words, and the solution has got to be a commitment to full employment for everyone, not just veterans, because we're not getting anywhere. If you've got, 40% of Americans don't have full-time jobs.
All right, Larry, thanks. Thanks very much for the phone call. And, you know, I mean, I think the sentiment is well received here. Mm-hmm. Todd, you want to respond to some of the later comments, sir?
Yeah, I agree with him. You know, and like I always use the term sweat equity. The veteran wants to work. The VA systems are, and don't kick me, Aaron, but the VA systems are difficult to go through. And that's why we work collaboratively. We know these are huge federal bureaucracies. We know it's going to take time. And we try and coach the veterans through those application processes and keep them engaged. That sometimes they'll just simply withdraw because it's frustrating. But at the same time, we as a nonprofit could be doing other things to support the VA. You know, there was a definition mentioned earlier. You know, the VA has some definitions of veterans, and they got to work within those rules. You know, that's a huge federal bureaucracy. We're not going to change it at the community level. But at the same time, the city of Rochester has opportunities for those veterans. The nonprofit community has opportunities for those veterans that we don't abide by the same definitions, right? We're not tied to the same rules. So you can just see where people go, why does it need to be so much collaboration? I get the question all the time from a nonprofit that serves veterans. My taxes are going to the government. Why is the VA not doing their job? It's not that they're not doing a job. Some of these things need to be decentralized. Some of these things need to come back to the community level and let community people take care of the problems that are so unique in the community level. Job placement. You know, we know who are the veteran-centric, veteran-friendly hiring, and they're dying to hire veterans right now. Great companies. We can go off a whole list. Our job then is to work with the Department of Labor and work with the VA to get the veterans to the door, get them job placement training, and then get them into those jobs. So we're working very hard on that. Couldn't agree with them more, you know. Housing first, then the jobs and the families. We're getting those two put together.
Well, here's an email from a listener named Donna that kind of dovetails with what Larry was saying. Donna says, I applaud the White House on this, but I would like to see the White House now lean on employers to stop discriminating against veterans. And Donna says the next benchmark should be the same level of unemployment in the veterans community as in the general population. Well, you know, and again, Larry is referencing the fact that if you look at employment, full employment, unemployment rates, you know, who's participating in the workforce, there's different metrics. But regardless, right now the unemployment rate is somewhere between 5% and 6%. And again, that's one number. But I don't know what it is in the veterans population. It has always been much higher, right? Right, Todd and Aaron, hasn't it?
It used to be much higher, specifically to our returning veterans, our veterans that served in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't know the specific data right now. I do know that it's trending down, but I'm not able to give you that data.
And the last data I seen from New York State was below 7%.
So below 7?
Below 7%.
All right, so that's. I mean, again, I am not celebrating that number. It's got to be lower, but, you know, that's... Yeah. It sounds like a significant improvement on what I think I was used to hearing for a number of years.
So we have a part of our organization does job training, job placement, and they work with these employers around the whole region, you know, and in particular the five county regions around Monroe County. Listen, there are so many great jobs out there, so many great employers waiting to hire our veterans. Sometimes our hardest job is getting the veterans to our door, and we've really changed that paradigm of what we're trying to sell out there when we're talking to these. The veterans that want work, we can get them to work. Mm-hmm. The veterans that want, they're able to go to work, we can get them jobs. There's beautiful employers out there right now looking to even train you. They're looking for two things. Every employer is looking for work ethic and character, and that's what most veterans are coming with. They can be trained in almost everything else, but work ethic and character is what you can't train anybody in. So we've been using these opportunities that you're giving us right now. I mean, you know, if there's veterans out there looking for a better job, looking for their first job, looking for a better job, we have the jobs. I can guarantee that.
Well, and then maybe, Todd, you can respond to what Donna says. And Donna, if you're listening, who emailed the program, call us, because I'd like you to elaborate on what you said in the email. You said, I'd like to see the White House lean on employers to stop discriminating against veterans. So Donna seems to be saying, and I'm inferring now, that's why I'm saying, if you're listening, Donna, call us and elaborate. She seems to be saying that there's a stigma that employers are not as willing to hire veterans. Todd, what you're saying is you can get veterans jobs. Is there a stigma? You think that's gone?
Well, I think there's a hesitation, a stigma. Some people look at it as discrimination. I can't tell by the email if that's what she's saying, but you know, the post-traumatic, for instance, or the veterans are reservists, and they're going to be deployed for a year, and what am I going to do without that employee for a year? So there's definitely some baggage that would come along that puts, but the gains on the other side of what I said earlier, you know, you're getting work ethic, you're getting character, you're getting the soft skills that we all want. Our employers, they know how to say yes, sir, no, ma'am. They know how to be punctual. They work until the mission's complete. They know cultural diversity. They know problem solving. You know, so all these things usually outweigh what might be the stigma that comes with it. And I'm not sure if that's what she's referring to, but sometimes it's post-traumatic. Does every veteran have post-traumatic, or are they going to be deployed and gone for a year and a half?
Okay, so on PTSD, do we have any idea how much of the veteran homeless population has PTSD?
It's significantly higher than the general veteran population, which is right now between 20 and 30%. Again, veterans tend to underreport symptoms of mental health, so it's very difficult to get a specific number. It's a moving target.
Okay.
But generally speaking, our homeless veterans have significantly higher rates of whether it's post-traumatic stress, any type of mental health issue.
Okay. And then I think Todd is probably right, guessing based on Donna's email, if there's a stigma, maybe it is on PTSD. And if the rate of veteran homelessness is higher that has PTSD than the general veterans population, I imagine the unemployment rate is probably higher. How do we, Todd and Aaron, get to a point where employers know that should not be a disqualifying factor? That is a mental health issue like so many other things, but that doesn't mean do not hire this person. And again, I'm not saying most employers. I'm not even saying most, but how do we get past that?
That is probably, we have to get past that with landlords too. So we're here talking about homelessness, and I just want to bring it back a little bit. But it has to do with education. And that's why I think for me, that's why I wanted to really showcase what this community has done. Because the more education we do with our community, with our landlords, with our employers, with our other agencies, the more we will decrease the stigma. Because there is stigma. But when you think about it, there is stigma regarding our civilian population's mental health issues.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is stigma against mental health.
Depression.
And
so many things.
You know, why did you go out to the store today when you have depression if you can't get off the couch? Well, there are stages of recovery. And mental health issues are just as important as medical issues, and they are treated the same way. And yet, we still run up against a wall when it comes to that stuff.
Okay. Well, I think that's well said. Let's take our only break of the hour. And I want to come back and kind of work a little bit more through the numbers on, if you're just joining us, how did Rochester achieve what they call functional zero when it comes to veteran homelessness? And that doesn't mean no veteran homelessness. That means there are no veterans in our community right now who are saying, I need help, I need a place to stay, I need services, and the community simply has to say, we can't help you. That's not happening. And that is because of the collaboration of the agencies that you're hearing from today, as well as this outreach program that's been going on for a couple of years now. So I want to work through a little bit more of the numbers in terms of these 55 veterans. What does it mean for 33 to be in transitional housing? What does safe haven mean? That kind of a thing. And then we'll come back and we will talk a little bit more broadly with Carol Wheeler from the City of Rochester about homelessness more broadly. So if you've got more questions and comments, you can join the conversation, and we'll continue in just a moment on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we meet author Carola DeBell, author of The Only Ones. She's in Rochester because Writers and Books chose her novel for their debut novel series. We'll talk about the book. It's set in a kind of an apocalyptic and post-pandemic world. Disease has ravaged the population, but the book is really a story about motherhood through the eyes of a woman resistant to most diseases. That's our conversation next hour. Welcome back to Connections. An email from a veteran named Rick just asking about the age range of the homeless veteran population. He said he's just curious, wants to know, is it mostly older veterans? And is there a range that we know? Aaron?
No, homelessness does not, it is all ages for sure. We are currently working with a couple very young veterans who refuse to come into shelter. It varies. It could be 22, 24, it could be 60. We're working with a couple people that are, 70, 72. So it's across the gamut.
But 70s all the way down, you said, to low 20s.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So a wide range there. And the numbers, again, 55. This was a point in time count. So it's not probably a perfect number today. And this is a kind of number that could change, with some frequency, but I think is at least a good snapshot for our community. 55 homeless veterans, 17 in emergency housing, which means what kind of housing is emergency technically?
Emergency housing is one of our transitional housing programs. And that would be probably our contract residential program through the VA is what they're counting there. I want to just clarify that where they got these numbers is a program called HMIS, okay, which is a program that all of our homeless partners use to identify where people are. So they get if a veteran goes into a shelter or a civilian, they are entered into the system called HMIS. And it shows where our homeless folks are in the city, what shelters they're at, whether it's emergency housing. It gives us a way to track. And again, that was another thing that identified our area as functional zero, because we have to be able to track where our homeless veterans are. So it's probably our contract residential program. We have approximately 65 beds available at any given time. For people that are acutely homeless. A lot of those folks that you're mentioning, part of those 55, were awaiting permanent housing. So they're working with somebody potentially from the VOC or Richards House or Salvation Army or VA looking for permanent housing. If they don't have the income, we're working with them to get them a Section 8 voucher. We call that HUD-VASH. Or we're trying to work with our Supportive Services for Veterans and Their Families program to get them rapidly rehoused. But they have services wrapped around them at that point. They're in a program.
Okay. So 17 in emergency, 33 in transitional, 1 in safe haven. What does that mean?
Safe haven is a program that is specifically a housing first program for chronically homeless veterans. Now, to meet the criteria for chronic, it has changed a little bit. But chronically homeless means you've been street homeless for longer than 1 year, or you've been homeless 4 times in 3 years. So that was one of the populations that we were targeting specifically over the course of the last several years to make sure that we were hitting that chronically homeless population.
Okay. We've got Bob and Henrietta wants to weigh in on this conversation. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, good afternoon. I just wanted to tell you that I'm a ride captain with the Patriot Guard Riders, and I work a lot with the VA system. Also, I've worked with Todd Baxter, and we have a facility on Buffalo Road that we have donated furniture in, and through the VA system, donate the furniture to the veterans that get these apartments. So I just wanted to remind your panel there that that we're there for the veterans. And the way to get to us is is through the pgrny.org, and we're here to help. So if you'd like to have my email address, you can contact me.
All right, Bob, I know it's probably easy to find you if we look you up online. How would you say, how long have you been doing it, Bob?
We've been doing this now for 4 years, but through a lot of help from a lot of different organizations and also the PGR, we're starting to become quite popular. I think this week alone we took care of 6 homeless veterans that got apartments.
I was going to say, I think 4 of them are probably from VA. I want to tell you, your mission,
incredible.
We can't do what we do without folks like you. We can provide people permanent housing all day long, but if they walk into an apartment without belongings, without a feeling of home, it's likely they're going to end up homeless again. So thank you. We really rely on you.
Evan, that's what the community needs to hear right there. We keep on mentioning collaboration, and mm-hmm. the 30, 40 organizations. We don't even know most of them. I mean, that's the community won't even know most of them. They'll see those Patriot Riders with their flags at a funeral or something like that and not realize that they went out and found a problem, and they help us in ways that we can't do, you know, and moving furniture or even finding donated furniture and giving that to the veterans is essential. That's just a great example. There's so many great people out there helping right now.
Yeah, you can't just rely on government agencies to help with this. There's somebody on the grassroots side that's yeah. Todd's right. We see it at funerals. We see it sometimes welcome homes, those
right.
kind of things.
Right.
That sense of community and home
yeah.
is so big. And I want to welcome a guest who just popped into the studio. And I want to say welcome
Superman.
To Emil
That's
Anderson.
Right.
How are you, sir? Here, grab that microphone. Okay. Get nice and close.
All righty. Thank you, sir.
Are you comfortable? I know you just got into the studio here. I want to make sure you're...
A little nervous.
A little nervous? Oh, yes. Well, listen, I hope you've got nothing to be nervous about. Well, why don't you tell us, Mr. Anderson, tell us about your service, first of all.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. I joined the service in 1971 to 73.
Okay. And how are you doing now?
I'm doing great now.
It's quite a story.
I'm doing fantastic now.
And I know it's been a bit of a road for you. Tell us about some of the ups and downs that you've gone through.
Well, the easiest way for me to say this, tell this is to tell my story. I'm a Vietnam vet. I came home in 1973 looking for work. I was struggling to find a job. I was standing on Main Street across from the convention center, and a gentleman walked up to me because I still had on my veteran shirt. Excuse me. And he said, "You look lost." And I said, "Yeah, I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I'm trying to find a job." He said, "Go down the street on St. Paul, and there is a little building called the VOC." And he told me to go down there and see if I can get some help because they're helping vets. And at the time, it was a little tiny building, and I went into the building, and the veterans there welcomed me home, and they started trying to help me find work. And And what happened was, after going to the VOC, I started off getting a job at Gleason's, and I was a grinder for Gleason's, and I did that for a few years, and then they had a cutback, and I had to leave there. And after I left there, about 6 months later, I got a job at Edison Tech High School, and I became a school sentry.
And you were how old?
I was 20.
Okay.
At the time. And I'm glad you asked that question about how old, because let me just interject here for a minute with this. A lot of people look at a veteran like myself today, and they see this older guy who's a veteran who served this country, but they forget about the fact that when I went in 71, I was 17 years old. My birthday's in February, and I turned 18 in boot camp. Mm-hmm. And by the time I was 19, I was overseas. And, my struggle with being homeless and my drug addiction, which is I'll get to, mm-hmm. Part of that was I was a kid. I didn't know how to live. I mean, I went in the Marine Corps, and I was 17 years old, and I came out my mother's house. So by the time I came back home, I'm this grown up who doesn't know how to finance his money. He's never paid rent. He's never owned a car. He's never done anything as far as managing his life. learning how to live life on life terms. I didn't know how to do that. So I came home, and it was a struggle. So after I worked at Edison for years, I worked there 20 years, and I got hurt breaking up some fights, because as a school sentry, your job is to break up fights, chase the kids to class, and things of that nature. And when I got hurt, I had to have spinal surgery. And I had spinal surgery a couple of times, and I got addicted to prescription drugs. And when the prescription drugs ran out, I turned to street drugs. And the struggle of the street drugs led me to homelessness.
And again, at this point, you're how old?
I'm 63 years old now.
But no, but I mean, I'm talking about
At the time that that happened, by that time I was, about 40-something.
Okay, about 40?
Yeah, about 41, 43.
And your story is so similar that we hear people go through addiction to prescription painkillers,
yes,
and then kind of chasing that to street drugs.
Yes.
And so you became homeless?
I became homeless.
What happened?
Well, what happened was because of the use of the street drugs, I couldn't manage my rent. A little bit before that, it was always a struggle managing my rent, managing living life on life terms. But it became really desperate by the time I started using prescription drugs. When I got addicted to the prescription drugs and then the street drugs, it really became difficult to manage my life or pay my bills or not become homeless, because I was in a state of drug-induced life. Mm-hmm. So what happened was, so I'm so thankful, and I have to share this, I am so thankful that this collaborative of these organizations were available to me by the time I made a decision to get my life together. Because what I did was, there was a gentleman, I always have to mention his name. His name is Mike Rude. And he was the homeless vet guy. We always called him the homeless vet guy. But Mike Rude was the gentleman who dealt with homeless vets. If you needed some help, you can call Mike. And I called Mike and I said, I'm about to commit suicide. I can't do it anymore. I had some sleeping pills. I was going to take them and just lay down and die, because I just couldn't do it anymore. I was going to give up on life. And Mike says, don't do that. I'll be there in 5 minutes. And I said, yeah, okay, whatever. And because I didn't think he meant it. And in 5 minutes, he was there. And I said, wow, how did this guy get here so quick? Because I didn't know where he was when I called him. And I'm like, how did he get here so quick? Turns out he was around the corner helping another vet. And he came right around the corner, and he picked me up, and he took me on South Avenue, and he talked to me, and he says, if I can get you an inpatient, would you go? And I said, yes.
Well, do you think you would have taken those pills had he not been there that day?
I do. I really do.
Why did you call him then? That's
a wonderful part of the story, too. What happened was, I had made a decision to take these pills, and I was just going to kill myself. And just before I did it, I'm a very spiritual guy. I was raised in the Catholic Church, and I says, oh my God, if I take these pills, I commit suicide. God is not going to let me into heaven. So anyways, I read a passage in the Bible, and it said, weep and endure it for a night, but joy cometh in the morning. And I said, okay, all right, God, I'll wait till the morning. So I went to take off my pants to go to sleep, and Mike Rude's card dropped out of my pocket. And so I was like, oh, okay, God, that's a funny joke, whatever. And so I put the card back in my pocket, and I went and laid down and went to sleep. And when I got up that morning and went to put my pants back on, the card fell out my pocket a second time. And I said, okay, what are you saying? Call Mike? All right, I'll call Mike, but I know he's not going to help me. And I called him, and he says, I'll always help you, Emil. And he came right around, and he picked me up. And like I said, he took me on South Avenue, and he said, if I can get you an inpatient, would you go? I said, yes. And he got me into Canandaigua. To Canandaigua inpatient. I went to the Dom. I stayed 68 days. After the 68 days that I stayed at the Dom, they referred me to the Richards House. The Richards House is a halfway house for vets on South Avenue. And there's a wonderful lady there named Judy Gilbert. I always have to mention Judy because she's a big part of my story. When I first got to the Richards House, Judy used to get on my case all the time, and I was like, this lady, I can't stand her. You know. But what I learned from her was I didn't know how to live life on life terms. And she told me one day, she says, if you can't handle my little crap in here, you're not going to be able to handle anything out there. So I said, you know, I got it. When she said it, I got it. I was like, oh, okay, she's right. I need to be able to accept the fact that I don't know what I'm doing. She does. Listen to her and follow her instructions. She told me to go to meetings, don't use, obey all the rules of the Richards House, and that I can help. It would help me get better. So I did that. And after 9 months of being at the Richards House, I moved down the street to Highland Manor in the apartments. And that's also another story, because when I was trying to get in Highland Manor, I had bad credit. Well, actually, I had no credit. And because of the homelessness from other places putting me out, they didn't want to let me. At first, they didn't want to let me in. Mike Rood went down there and talked to him. And then he helped me get on Shelter Plus, the VASH program, which is this collaborative of the program that helps pay your rent until you can get stabilized. So they helped me get into Highland Manor, and they checked on me, made sure I was okay. And I stayed at Highland Manor for 5 years. And with the help of them through VASH and Shelter Plus, I was able to save my little extra pennies. And I saved those extra pennies for 5 years. And then 3 years ago, I bought a house.
Oh, gosh, that is a great story.
So, and it would, if it wasn't for the program, I really have to keep going back to the collaboration of this program, the VOC, Westfall Road, Canandaigua. If I don't mention those people, I would just be making it seem like I did. This is really all about them. I mean, it's about me, but okay. It's about them. There's no me without them.
But here's where people like Todd, I've been hearing him say it for a long time. You know, one of the most important parts of the story is you made a decision. I'm ready to try to move forward with this. Now, yes. Granted, someone kept knocking that card out of your pocket. That's one thing.
Yes.
But you also decided, I want to participate. I don't want to be homeless anymore.
Yes.
And you kind of had to want to grab that and choose it and participate in it. It doesn't mean it happens overnight.
No.
But, you know.
No, it doesn't.
I know they appreciate the credit you're giving them, but it also started with you and a decision you made.
And you know what? It is a big part of me making that decision, because until you're ready, you're not ready. Mm. And so my decision to do that helped guide me. But the program gave me the tools. It gave me some of the tools that I needed. Like Judy Gilbert said, go to a meeting, Emil. And there was days I didn't want to go, and she says, Emil, go to a meeting. And I go to the meeting. I go to an NA or AA meeting, and I get information on how to stay clean one day at a time. Don't use the tools that we give you here, and you can make it. So on a daily basis, I had to make a decision not to use. Not to say that in early recovery, I didn't think of using. I did. I did think about going back out and using and stuff, but I always try to. And the program of Narcotics Anonymous, they told me, they said, remember your story. So every time I remember my homeless story, I say, I don't want to do that one again.
Emil, I hope a lot of people have heard your story. 3 years in a house?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations.
Right now I have 8 years, 8.5 years clean.
Amen.
And it started in Canandaigua, 68 days. And here it is, 8.5 years later, and life has turned around.
I'm proud to know you.
Thank you, sir.
And it's great to hear your story. And you know, look what happened, Carol Wheeler. I got caught up in Emil's story. I wanted to talk to Carol more about homelessness more broadly.
No,
don't you apologize.
No.
Carol and I are like, let him go. I want to hear this story, you know. But Carol, we got about 90 seconds left here. And this is part of the city's battle against homelessness more broadly. What do you want our listeners to know about in that context?
What I want everyone to know is that assisting and supporting our homeless, it is so very important that we know that we as city government can't do it alone. But again, as I was mentioned earlier in the broadcast, that it is a community issue. It is definitely a community issue, and the only way that it's going to be solved is in the event that we're all communicating and collaborating and making sure that when we're making our decisions, that we have people like Emil included in those discussions as those decisions are being made, because they have lived through it. Mm-hmm. And there is some valuable information that they can provide to help our process. We're steady evolving, and I'm certain
with the passion that everyone has in this room and others in the community. And if you haven't identified yourself yet, please come forward and help us.
Well, congratulations, first of all, on this achievement of Functional Zero. That's not to say that there are no problems left. No, nobody should leave this broadcast with that implication in mind. I mean, this is an ongoing challenge, but it's a community that is in many ways meeting it more effectively than ever. As you heard, Rochester, the 15th community across the country recognized in this way out of more than 800 that would love to be in that category. Thanks very much to our guests here, and Emil, continued success to you. Thanks for being here and telling your story. Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome.
Aaron and Todd, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
More Connections next.